Jesus, in his coming into the world, came to change our thinking. And he came to change it in drastic ways that we're not always prepared for. How much of the thinking of the Western world has been changed by the thinking of Christ and by his influence, I am not sure that we'll ever be able to determine. He's so much a part of our culture that many times we have come to thought patterns that we're not even aware belonged to him. One of the things in this passage in Matthew 7:15 brings this to my attention, and I use it just simply by way of introduction to show you the vastness of the influence of Jesus, and yet to show you a kind of influence upon the human race that really doesn't amount to much. There's an expression here, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves." Now there's an expression in there that is an example of unconscious influence. And I'm not going to tell you what it is. Let me tell you some others that are similar to that, not only from the teachings of Jesus, but from the Old Testament scriptures. In the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32 and verse 10, the writer Moses there, it's a song that Moses sang concerning God's treatment of Judah. And he says that God had kept Judah like the apple of his eye. Now, there's another statement of something that has become so much a part of us that we don't really know that it came from the Old Testament or it came from the Judeo-Christian writings. Again, in Isaiah, the 40th chapter and verse 15, the writer there says that all of the nations are but a drop from a bucket. Did you ever hear that expression? We may have changed it and said, well, that's nothing more than a drop in a bucket. But it indicates, and it's an illustration of this unconscious influence that the world has received from Jesus and from the Old Testament writings. The kiss of death that was laid upon Jesus by Judas. When Judas came and he had given a sign and said, the one that I kiss, that's the one, take him. That kiss of death has actually become the standard by which the underworld today indicates who is to be rubbed out, who's to be killed. And when a contract is let, and that means that whenever the mafia and the underworld decide that they're going to kill someone, they let a contract on him, they hire a killer, and one of those men actually goes up to the victim and kisses him. Well, they got that from Judas. And whether it predates Judas, I don't know. But such expressions as straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel. I wonder how many people in the world use that expression, not knowing that it originated in the teachings of Jesus. And when people become exceptionally picky, they say, well, you're straining at a gnat. Well, that's part of the influence of Jesus on our society. And so it is with this expression here, a wolf in sheep's clothing. Well, the world uses that to the point, and not only that expression, but that's the one that's in our text tonight, a wolf in sheep's clothing. But so many in my mind, almost it went blank as I began to search and try to find these unique expressions that have become so much a part of our own culture and so much a part of our own expression of thought that they have actually become idioms of the English language rather than expressions out of the Hebrew language. And we've become the inheritors. We've become those who have inherited a kind of thought pattern in a sense, and yet it's so superficial because it's not really applied on the level that Jesus Christ intended these things to be applied. And we've come to be a nation who can quite comfortably coin our, or mint our coins, make our money, and on those coins print, "In God we trust." And we can go right on with such flippant observances as these and such unconscious expressions of cliches, if you like to call them that, or expressions like we've mentioned, not a drop in a bucket, or the apple of the eye, or render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, or the kiss of death, or straining at a gnat, or any of these, we can go on and be a people who superficially accept such as this and go on and parrot it like we were parrots, and yet it not go any deeper than that. But that's not what I mean, and that's not what Jesus meant when he came to change our thinking. He calls us to a greater dedication than just this superficial acceptance of expressions and things that he used during his life's ministry here among us. Christ calls us to a much deeper commitment than that. And I mentioned that just by way of introduction, and I'm not sure it's relevant to the theme tonight, but I think it is. The theme in this last paragraph, as we're noticing, or this last section, the theme is the urgent need for entering the narrow gate. And Jesus approaches it with all that's in him to try to convince us of the urgency of this entering into the narrow gate. Verses 13 and 14, he tells us simply, enter the narrow gate, for the gate is broad and the way is wide that leads to destruction. And many there are that go in thereat, but he said the way is hard, the gate is narrow, or the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and few are they that find it. He makes this distinction between the broad way and the narrow way, and he urges us to choose that narrow way. Then in verses 15 through 19, he talks to us, or rather it's in the next verses 15 through 23, he talks to us about two hindrances, two things that would hinder our entering the narrow way. One of these we're going to be discussing tonight is false prophets. The other that he says is false discipleship. One of these is directed by the grace of Jesus. He approaches the people as though the false prophets would not arise from them. He tells these people to beware of false prophets as though they would come to them from other quarters. And I think that that's part of the nature of Jesus, to give the best and to assume the best in people, though he knew people inside and out. But he directed the attention of this audience to those who would come in from some other quarter as aliens, in a sense, and would be false prophets preying on these people. But then he turns to them also and warns them against false discipleship, and more or less says, now this is a warning for you. There are going to be a lot of people, he says, approach me in that day and say, Lord, did we not do this and that and the other in your name? But he says, not everybody that says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven. And that's more of a general warning. That's more for the people. That's more for us as the mass of people. And then finally, in verses 24 through 27, Jesus gives a very practical description of the outcome of both adhering to his words and of denying his words. He said, he that hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man that built his house upon the rock. But the man that hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a man that built his house upon the sand. And he says these two different approaches to my teaching produce two different, very drastically different effects. One of the houses will stand. That was built upon my teachings will stand. That which is not built upon my teachings will not stand. There's one common theme that keeps recurring through this last part, from verses 13 through 23, and that is the constant reference to the final judgment. In the verses 13 and 14, Jesus refers to it as destruction and life. I don't think he necessarily means that this way waits until the final judgment before destruction and life set in. This way leads to destruction in life even now. But ultimately, the ultimate final end of entering in by the narrow gate will be life. The ultimate and final end of entering in through the broad way will be destruction. And so he calls to our mind, even at the very outset of this asking us to determine and decide where we're going to enter, he calls to our mind that there's going to be a judgment. In the next phrase in this paragraph here, or in this next paragraph, he talks about every tree that does not bear good fruit is going to be cut down and thrown into the fire. That's a reference to the final judgment. And then he talks further when he says, on that day, what day? On the day of judgment. On the day when men stand before God. They're going to say, Lord, did we not do this, that, and the other in your name? And so he calls to our attention that there's going to be a final day of judgment. And so we're brought back again to this whole subject of judgment, which is the subject of the seventh chapter in particular. It's the subject of the entire Sermon on the Mount, as it includes all of the instruction, as he asks us to judge ourselves with a judgment that is very strict. He asks us then, in the light of having judged ourselves, to judge God in his mercy and then judge others accordingly as we would like to be judged. But then he says, finally, remember that all of us, all of you, are going to finally be judged in a final judgment at the day of judgment. And he calls this to their attention. And he does it three times in these last three paragraphs. The thing that I want to mention tonight is that of false prophets. It had been announced as being, by their fruits you'll know them. That won't be the emphasis, I don't think, tonight. I never was able to quite get a hold of that. But I do want to talk to you about false prophets, and I want to bring to your attention some things that I believe are eminently important. They are urgently needed, as we discover, as we discuss and try to discover the way we're supposed to walk before God. The coming of false prophets was a matter of certainty. Jesus never questioned the fact that false prophets would come. But I want to mention tonight two different aspects of the false prophets that I think are due our consideration. Number one, Jesus Christ talked about false prophets as being one of the things that would precede the coming of the destruction of Jerusalem. And I didn't turn to this, and I don't know how it turned to it. I don't know yet. Let me throw it out for your thinking. Jesus talked about false prophets in the sense of that which would precede the coming of the destruction of Jerusalem. I want to read from Matthew 24 very briefly. In verse 11, he says, "And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray." And if you want to turn and read that with me, do that, please. And I'll have to go ahead and talk while you're turning. But in the 24th chapter of Matthew, he's discussing the coming of the destruction of Jerusalem primarily. That's the primary application of Matthew 24. And it's in that connection that Jesus says here, there are going to be many, many false prophets. Now on over again then in Mark the 13th chapter and verse 22, he makes another statement. And there he says, false prophets will arise and show signs and wonders to lead astray, if possible, the elect. Now that's a parallel chapter to Matthew 24. In this particular context, he's saying, but when you see the desolating sacrilege set up where it ought not to be, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down nor enter into his house. And on he gives instruction as to how the people in Jerusalem and in Judea should conduct themselves in the prospect of the coming of the Roman armies to destroy Jerusalem. And it's in that context of the destruction of Jerusalem that he says there are going to be many false Christs arise. There are going to be many false prophets who will come and say, here's the Christ, come follow him. He says, don't listen to that, because as the lightning is seen from the east to the west, he says, so will the Son of Man be seen in his coming. But he said there are going to be false prophets that will arise. And in view of that, it never ceases to amaze me the practicality of the teachings of Jesus Christ as they relate to those issues that were imminently at hand at the time that he spoke. And I marvel at how relevant the teachings of Jesus were to the Jewish time in which he lived. For example, and this was one reason why they so objected to Jesus, in the book of Matthew, in this Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus says, you've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, he said, I say to you, no, that's not true. Do not resist one who is evil. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If anyone would sue you, take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. If one forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Do you know who it was the Jew had in mind as he heard these very revolutionary instructions on how to live your life? He had the Roman in mind. The stinking, arbitrary, obstinate, overbearing, cruel Roman soldier. That's who he had in mind. And that's why the teachings of Jesus had such a startling effect upon people. He goes on and says, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But the Jew translated that even while it was in the mouth of Jesus. When he said, love your enemy, love your neighbor, that meant love the Jews. And hate your enemy, he translated the word enemy immediately to be Romans. Hate those Romans. And on down through there. But Jesus said, I say no, you love your enemies. Pray for those that persecute you. And on, the revolutionary teachings of Jesus Christ as they were made applicable to the Jewish-Roman situation as it existed in the times in which Jesus lived. Let me give you another illustration of it. In Luke, the 13th chapter, turn quickly there, Luke 13 and verse 3, a very familiar passage to us. It's been quoted a million times by preachers in the 19th and 20th centuries. I tell you no, but unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. That statement has been quoted, and I'm confident that it's been taken out of its context, though the general call that it makes to repentance from sin is appropriate. It still is not applied by Jesus in the way that many of us and most preachers today apply it to today. Jesus spoke this in the context of the Roman-Jewish relationship that was bringing upon the Jewish nation such imminent destruction. Jesus asked this question. He said, well, the first verse there says, there were some present at that time who told him of the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. And they told him about this gory incident and all the gory details about how the governor Pilate had actually mixed and mingled the blood of these Galileans with their sacrifices upon the altar in Jerusalem. And it was such sacrilege. And Jesus asked the question, do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered like this? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. And he's simply saying there, unless you stop your rebellion, unless you start loving your enemies like you love your neighbor, unless you start praying for those that persecute you, unless you stop this endless rebellion that you Jews are guilty of continually, he said, you're going to suffer the same fate that those people suffered who Pilate mixed their blood with their sacrifices. Now, incidentally, this particular incident here of Pilate mixing the blood of these Galileans with the sacrifices, we're told that this was the incident that caused such enmity between Pilate and Herod. Now, you know, back on over into the life of Christ, when he was being crucified, Pilate sent him to Herod, and it says that up until this time, they had been at enmity with each other. Do you know why? It was because Pilate had overstepped his jurisdiction. It was Herod who was the governor of Judea. Pilate was the governor of Herod was the governor of Galilee. Pilate was the governor of Judea. Pilate had no jurisdiction over those Galileans. And he had overstepped his jurisdiction by taking Galileans who were under Herod's jurisdiction, crucifying them or sacrificing them and mixing their blood with their sacrifices. And it had made these two men at odds with each other. When he sent him Jesus and he saw Jesus, it says they became friends from that day on. But the point I'm making here was that Jesus Christ dealt with a very present problem that existed in the Jewish nation. And it was that obstinate, unyielding, selfish, critical attitude of the Jewish people that was such a thorn under the saddle of the Roman government. And Jesus just simply said, if you don't stop it, if you don't quit this rebellion, if you don't quit hating these Romans, if you don't quit living like the world lives, they're going to come in and absolutely destroy you and not leave one stone left upon another. Now, there's further evidence of this in Luke, the 19th chapter, when Jesus there, as he approached the city of Jerusalem, actually stopped and cried. He wept. And yet he knew that the destruction of Jerusalem was coming. He knew it was coming. A few days later, he told it in detail, how that there would not be left one stone upon another, that would not be thrown down. But as he drew near, in verse 41 of chapter 19 of Luke, when he drew near and saw the city, he cried. He wept over it. And this is not the same kind of weeping. It's a different word from the word that was used when it says he wept at Lazarus' death. That was just a silent sobbing. This word means that he cried and he wept over his own people. He was moved to such an extent over the people of his own city that he literally broke out and cried aloud. Well, why would he do it? Because he was moved over the obstinacy of these people whose hearts were so hardened that they could not surrender themselves to be God's people and live in God's way. And this particular passage here, he says, would that even today you knew the things that make for peace. But now they are hid from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will cast up a bank about you and surround you and hem you in on every side and dash you to the ground, you and your children within you, and they'll not leave one stone upon another in you because you did not know the time of your visitation. And Jesus wept over the fact that they would not listen to him tell them the things that pertain to peace. Well, what was it that he was telling them that pertained to peace? Here's what it was. Love your enemies. Pray for those that persecute you. If he asks you to go 1 mile, go two. If he takes your coat, give him your cloak as well. If he slaps you on one cheek, turn the other one. And when he saw that they turned a deaf ear to all such teaching as that, that would have perhaps helped them escape the destruction of Jerusalem, or at least caused it to not be so terrible, when he saw that they turned a deaf ear to it, he just literally broke down and wept and said, oh, how I wish that even right now you would know the things that belong to peace. But he said, they're hid from your eyes. The false prophet warning, I'm confident in Jesus' teaching, had as its primary reference those false prophets who would come to the Jewish nation and try to convince them that they ought to be insurrectionists and they ought to throw off the bondage of Rome by force. And they ought to run those heathen, those uncircumcised heathen, out of their land. I'm confident that that was the primary reference that Jesus had to false prophets. Listen, in and around the time that Jesus lived, there were 64 false Christs. 64 of them. You know the name of two of them, Theudas and Judas. In Acts, the 5th chapter, when Gamaliel stood up and said, listen, there were other men who have risen up before at other times, Theudas and Judas, and they were dispersed. They were killed. The people that followed them were dispersed. Nothing came of it. Leave these men alone. And you know the story there. But we know the names of two of these false Christs, two of these false prophets. And Jesus said they will come. And in John the 10th chapter, Jesus spoke of those prophets and those false Christs who had preceded him. And in John the 10th chapter, he says, all who have come before me were thieves and robbers. Who was he talking about? I thought, well, now surely he's not talking about Moses and Elijah and all those people. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers. Who's he talking about? He's talking about all those false prophets, all those false Christs, who kept trying to get the children of Israel, the Jewish nation, to rise up in arms and to throw off the yoke by force. Jesus said these people just came to steal and to destroy. And says he who is a hireling is not the shepherd, whose own the sheep are not. He sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He talks about it in the same terms that he talks about them here. He says, beware of these false prophets that come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravening wolves. One of the very 12 disciples that Jesus had on his own, as his own disciple, one of them was Simon the Zealot. You know who he was? Simon was a former member of the Jewish underground. The Zealot party of the Jewish nation at that time was a Jewish underground party, an insurrectionist party, a party that was a subversive party, a party of whose a creed, what part of whose creed was that they would wear a dagger under their cloak and they would kill any Roman that they could kill and get away with it. Simon was a former Jewish underground member. And the Lord rescued him from that suicide. And the man became a dispenser of life rather than a dispenser of death. But I think that the thing that Jesus referred to him imminently, immediately, was that false prophesying that would say to people, come on, we can do it. Get your swords, let's go. Jesus was arrested, and he was accused by these people of being a leader of an insurrection. Pilate asked him, "Is your kingdom? What about it?" He said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight. But because the people thought it was, and because the people wanted it to be of this world, and Jesus would not fit their mold and their preconceived idea of what the Christ was supposed to be, because he wasn't what they wanted, they killed him." But then there's not only that reference to false prophets, and I think you'll have to consider it. There's another reference to false prophets that would come in the last days. Not in the days there, but in the last times. Look at 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. 2 Peter 2, "But false prophets also arose among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them, bringing upon themselves swift destruction, and many will follow their licentiousness, and because of them the way of truth will be reviled, and in their greed they will exploit you with false words. From of old their condemnation has not been idle, and their destruction has not been asleep." Look back again at 1 Peter, or 1 Timothy, chapter 4, verse 1. "Now the Spirit says expressly that in later times some will depart from the faith by giving heed to deceitful spirits, doctrines of demons, through the pretensions of liars whose consciences are seared, who forbid marriage and enjoin abstinence from food, or command to abstain from meats." Look at 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. And I want you to notice how much of this is exactly diametrically opposed to what Jesus Christ taught in the Sermon on the Mount. But understand this, that in the last days there will come times of stress, for men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant. Look, listen to how much of this contradicts to the face what Jesus taught was the way that the kingdom of God was to be conducted and would have you live your life. "Men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, inhuman, implacable, slanderers, profligates, fierce, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding a form of religion but denying the power of it." Now all of these, he says, all of this is going to happen in the latter days, the last days. So you've got false prophets. Jesus spoke of them as coming in conjunction with the destruction of Jerusalem, and he warned the people to get away from those people. He said it's like holding an adder in your breast. He said as certainly as you do it, you're going to perish. And then he says now they're going to be false prophets in the last days, and they're going to also lead astray, if possible, even the very elect. And Paul warned the elders at Ephesus that even from among them their own selves, men would arise speaking perverse things to draw away men after themselves. Now, what is the nature of their work? And then we're going to close. Two things. Their work was characterized by two things. Their method is subtlety. I can't draw any other conclusion from what Jesus says when he says that they'll come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're going to be ravening wolves. Subtlety. They're going to appear one thing on the outside, something else entirely different on the inside. And that's also what we find in 1 Timothy 4, as I read a moment ago. Two words crop up there, deceitful and pretensions. And in 2 Thessalonians 2, 9 and 10, the same two words crop up, deception and pretension. And then in 2 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, verses 12 through 15, when the writer there says that you ought not to marvel, he said Satan's own, let me read that, 2 Corinthians, he talks about the characteristics of Satan. He said in verse 13 of chapter 11 of 2 Corinthians, "For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ." You see all of these words that describe subtlety? They'll be deceitful. They'll be disguising themselves. They are false apostles. And he says, no wonder. Even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So it is not strange if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. You see, that's part of the work of a false prophet. He will not come out and say what he says publicly. He'll say it in private. He'll say it quietly. He'll say it covertly. He'll say it in a way that's not open and above board. One of the characteristics of Jesus' teaching was that he said, "I spoke everything in public." He said, I didn't hide anything. They were accusing him, you know, of being subversive. He said, and they asked him, what have you been teaching? He said, ask anybody that's heard me. He said, I taught daily in your synagogues and in your temple. He said, I've taught openly. They know what I taught. And he says that the quality of a false prophet, though, is that he'll be deceptive. He'll be subtle. He'll not speak what he speaks publicly. He'll not be open. It'll be something that will be said covertly. It'll only be able to be spoken in private, and he would not have anyone at all know what he really and truly thinks. He wouldn't say it publicly if his life depended on it. He'll get around in groups, and he'll talk it here and there, and he'll take one brother here, and he'll take another sheep there, and he'll come in, and yet, though he looks like a sheep, he'll absolutely devour that person one at a time. One at a time. And he'll do it by subversion, by subtlety. Their method is subtlety. Their message is subversion. I can't come to any other conclusion other than that either, because of where this fits into this chapter here. Right after talking about the narrow and the broad way, then the very next thing that he says is, be careful of false prophets. And the quality that I'm confident that he talks about here is that their message will be one of subversion. Whatever undermines the message of Jesus, whatever makes broad his narrow way. And don't think that just because you're narrow-minded that that necessarily means that you are on the Lord's narrow wavelength. The Jehovah's Witnesses pride themselves upon being a very small group of people, and they claim that that's evidence that they're the children of God. Rubbish. That doesn't prove anything. You could start a group smaller than that, and then that itself would be evidence of your being the child of God. But that's not true. Nor is it true that just because you think that you're narrow, you may not be on the Lord's narrow wavelength at all. But whatever would make broad the narrow way of the Lord, whatever would open up gates that he wouldn't open, whatever would make possible things that he doesn't make possible. Let me just list two or three of them that are being used today to lead people into areas that Jesus never intended. The nature of the kingdom. It's not like many people proclaim it to be. How to become a Christian. It's harder and simpler, if you please, than many people will allow it to be. There are those people who are saying that there are no requirements. Just anybody that wants to, raise your hand, touch the radio, do anything you please. These people are false prophets and false apostles. They're false teachers, and they ought to be branded as such. Beware of them. Now he says, by their fruits you'll know them. What are the fruits of a false prophet? I wrestled with it, and I don't know that I've yet come up with it, but I think maybe that here's a clue. There are two basic fruits of a false apostle or a false prophet. And I want you to turn with me to 2 Peter again and look at this, if you will. 2 Peter chapter 2, and we'll close with this. But Jesus mentions you're going to know them by their fruits. He mentions this twice in this paragraph. You're going to know them by their fruits. Well, what are the fruits of a false prophet? Chapter 2 of 2 Peter begins by saying, but false prophets also arose among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you. And he goes on and describes how that they'll bring in destructive heresies. That's their teaching. They'll deny the master who bought them. That's their teaching. And then he goes on and says that many will follow. Their licentiousness, that's their life. And because of them, the way of truth will be reviled. And he goes on and talks about their destruction. But now look at verse 10. In verse 9, it says, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trial and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment, but especially whom? Especially those who indulge in the lust of defiling passion and despise authority. Peter identifies these two fruits of false teachers. He singles them out. Of all the other fruits that you could have mentioned, he singles out two major fruits. One is rebellion to authority. The other is indulging in defiling passions, and he means here sexual immorality. These two things, he says, are the major fruits of the false teacher. Jesus warns us against both of them. He warned us against this thing of denying and rebelling against authority. That's what caused the undoing of the Jewish nation. They were destroyed because they simply would not yield to the authority. And then finally, he warned us against the sexual immorality. And today, the two qualities of this chaos that we're witnessing in today's generation, in today's world, the two outstanding characteristics that identify today's problem is this. Number one, this thing of defiling passions and sexual abuse. And then second, that of absolutely denying that there's any authority over you at all. Rebellion against authority. And he mentions that as being the two fruits of false prophets, false teachers. Maybe this hasn't gotten to the text, but I felt like it needed to be said. We might need to go back later and go back again and look at it again, but I feel like that these two qualifications, these two classifications of false prophets, those that had to do with the coming of the destruction of Jerusalem, and those that have to do with the end of time in which we're living today. Be careful. May I sum it up with just one statement? What Jesus is talking about here is any yielding of ourselves to any current temptation to surrender our uniqueness to the pressures of the time, to where we, instead of being transformed by the renewing of our minds, find ourselves becoming conformed to the world. Now that's the central theme that you can put your foot on. Anytime you find yourself being tempted to sacrifice the uniqueness that belongs to Jesus Christ and those that follow him because of the pressure to be like the times in which you're living, you can count on it. That is false prophetry. And we've got to beware of it. Jesus called us to be a unique people. He called us to be different from the world in which we live. And brethren, pray God that he'll give us the strength. Whenever we see those things around about us that would call us and say, this is the way, you better check and see if it's what Jesus Christ would have you do. Or someone says, here is the Christ, you better check and see if it really and truly is in accord with his teachings. Because if it isn't, you are becoming, and I, the victim of false prophets, and that will keep you out of the narrow way, and it'll keep you out of heaven. And God bless us. Let's study these things and be serious about them. We're on to something that's eternal. Let's not muff it. Let's not make a mistake and miss it. May God bless us as we try to enter the narrow gate. Pray for God's wisdom to be given us. If you're here tonight and you need to respond for some reason or other, if you need to become a Christian, you'll have to do more than put your hand on your radio. You'll have to do more than sign a card, but it's so simple. All you have to do is come forward with faith in Jesus, turning your back upon sin and being immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins, committing yourself to Jesus as Lord. That's how you become a Christian. And there isn't any other way to become one than that. And those of us now who are Christians, will you determine now as we stand and sing to commit yourself to the Lord? May I and may you while we stand and sing.